Welcome to the Action for Happiness podcast. I'm your host, Guy. Joined beside me, as always, is my good friend, Anne. This is a very special episode as we speak with the father of modern mindfulness, the incredible Jon Kabat-Zinn.
In a way, how would you ignite passion in someone for the deep wisdom that already is available to them?
And I think for me, that's almost like a superpower.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a nice way to put it. It is a superpower. I mean, no neuroscientist even knows what a thought is. They don't know what awareness is. They don't know how you get it out of 3 pounds of meat in the head. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Okay? Sometimes it goes this way, sometimes it goes that way.
Yeah.
This is our first attempt at carpool podcasting, and we talk about John's latest work, social media, philosophy, and much more. Action for Happiness is a movement of people committed to building a happier and more caring society. Visit actionforhappiness.org for more details and subscribe to the YouTube channel to get the latest videos and podcasts.
Okay. Let's do this.
So, you felt good about it last night?
Yeah.
There are a few places where I just forgot what the hell I was talking about.
No, but that's the beauty of it, because, you know, you're so in the present moment. It's like when we do the podcast sometimes.
I think I was so jet-lagged, that plus I've been talking for like 4 days, so after a while it's like,
yeah,
what am I saying? You know, it's like...
Yeah, I love the bit how you mentioned, like, when you got to speak abroad where there is that translator that has to... You know, because you say your bit, then he translates, then you kind of lose your spot. But the point that you were making is like, you know, well... It doesn't need to be in a foreign language. You could lose your train of thought even in English as well.
That wasn't the point I was making.
Yeah, exactly. But
that is the point that I made.
Yeah. And it's funny how, like, you know, humor can play such a big role in, you know, in delivering these talks.
I was a little frustrated because the energy in the room was so phenomenal.
Oh, that's great.
That I wanted to actually have questions and answers at the end, but... I basically just ran out of time.
Yeah.
Because they were, I had a dinner right afterwards, so they were pulling me away and telling me to stop. There's no traffic at this time of day, right?
Yeah, it's nice and pleasant.
Well, thanks for getting up this early, because there was like no other time to do this.
Yeah, and I thought it would be a good use of your time as well. I didn't really want to take up too much time yesterday.
Like, I wanted to see you guys.
You mentioned on our last podcast, it was Anne who introduced me to mindfulness.
Oh, is that so?
Yes.
So you were the original troublemaker.
Yeah. Well, you know, I never had any back pains or stresses, but Anne and I, for over 20 years, have loved to talk about Descartes, about philosophy.
Okay.
About the meaning of life, the purpose of life, so...
So you've been friends for a long time.
Yeah.
20 years?
At least, yeah.
How old are you guys?
I'm 35.
Okay.
And 36.
Okay. So you've known each other basically since you were kids?
Yeah. Exactly.
That's cool.
And
how did you meet?
Just from mutual friends.
Oh, really?
You know, on the clubbing scene.
Uh-huh. I see.
lots of partying.
Computer games at first, I think, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Before clubbing.
Good old Street Fighter.
Uh-huh.
And we... Anne introduced me to mindfulness, and then...
Because you grew up with it?
It was actually from college. It was...
And why don't you sit in the middle, so you can go...
Is there a seat button in the middle? So is that college?
Okay, good. There we go. Now we're, like, we're all on camera.
All on camera. So I was teaching at a college.
Yeah.
And the counselor at the college had an MBSR program.
Is that so?
For staff, yeah. So we were, there was eight of us, actually, eight teachers, and I was just straight away, you know, the idea, really got my attention.
Really?
That's fabulous. And I thought this is so good for students' attention.
Yeah.
You know, why are we not teaching them, you know, like you said on stage, you know, pay attention, kids, pay attention, pay attention to the mathematics, but we never teach them how. It was just, for me, something that's absolutely missing in our education system, needed, necessary, and personally, I benefited. So through our conversations, I introduced Guy, he loved it ever since.
That's phenomenal. That, you know, so it's basically grew out of your friendship, the two of you.
Yeah.
That's really something. I should do the podcast and interview you. In fact, I guess I am.
Yeah. Well, so we can, I mean...
So that should be part of it. I mean,
yeah, we don't like to do formal introductions. We just like to have a conversation.
Yeah,
we don't enjoy like. So
we're already in the
rolling.
Car,
exactly.
Right, we're already running.
Exactly.
Wonderful.
But one thing I'd like to add to that is, once Anne introduced me to it, we started watching your videos, and we started
just found me on YouTube.
Found you on YouTube, and yeah, and after that. All our podcasts changed from what we were doing to focus primarily on mindfulness.
I see. Okay, so before that, it had a different orientation.
Yeah, more like, you know, current events.
Oh, okay.
Bit of philosophy. The subject's important to us.
Yeah, philosophy, you mean. Yeah. The subjects that were important to you.
Yes.
Yeah, well, great.
And so the next 40-odd podcasts up to now have been about mindfulness.
That's beautiful.
So it's been the core of our podcast and the main thing.
Because, you know, one thing about philosophy, I mean, philosophy is beautiful, you know, all well and good. But it's been my observation that people who study lots of philosophy, it doesn't necessarily translate into well-being or happiness. It translates often into a huge amount of thinking about things.
Yeah.
And you can have various attitudes or philosophies about it, but it doesn't necessarily get enacted or embodied in the way you choose to live.
Yeah.
And but philosophy should be all about how you live on the basis of your understanding of the challenges of, you know, human life. So that's where, you know, there is a branch of philosophy called
Stoicism?
No. It's too early in the morning. Phenomenology.
Phenomenology.
And phenomenology, as I understand it, Husserl and Merleau-Ponty and Heidegger, I think, and people like that, are really asking fundamental questions about the nature of being. And of language and things like that. Yeah. And they, in some sense, seem to have the philosophical counterpart of mindfulness, but without a practice.
Yes, okay.
They had no practice. It's just the, you know, conceptual exercises and perspectives.
Yeah.
But when you come to encounter Buddhist meditative practices, which are the heart of which is mindfulness, then it gives you a way to live, you know, a way to be, live in accordance with the kind of deep understanding of the difference between the appearance of reality and the actuality of reality and form and emptiness and speech and silence and all sorts of things that otherwise are just mere concepts.
And that's what...
Does that make sense, what I
said?
Yeah, no,
it absolutely does. And I think that's why Anne and I love it so much, because we do practice, we have a formal meditation daily, right? But, yeah, so to finish my last point, it's... So not only has that become the focus of our podcast, mindfulness, but the focus of our lives, you know?
Yeah, it sounded that way.
We dedicate all our... My wife will come in and she will listen to Anne and I talking and she'll be like, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Because we talk about it so much and, so, and you know, it's...
So you guys are very, very close friends.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That's extraordinary.
Well, we have a group of about 10 of our friends that we kind of grew up together, but Anne and I have been the one that have...
Right, found this...
We bonded on
vector.
This. Yes, absolutely.
And the others, not so much.
No, I mean, and...
What do they think of you?
Some of those
have a little bit off the deep end.
Yeah. It's like, oh, here we go, Anne and G at it again. And there are other ones that are, you know, very receptive to it, but, you know, don't...
They haven't taken up the practice.
Yes,
yeah.
And at first I did come across as a bit patronizing and...
Because you were
so enthusiastic. Yeah, I was like...
So then you become a big advocate of mindfulness and annoy everybody.
Exactly.
Because you're attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, listen, I mean, I think the way I first encountered you was basically doing your podcast,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And I told Richard that, you know, I just loved it. I loved talking with you guys. I mean, I do a million things like that.
Yeah.
But I felt like we connected in a way that was special.
Incredible.
And I just felt like both of you, it's like, so that's why I was happy to say connect up with you again, you know. To say nothing of the fact that you're part of Action for Happiness,
yes,
and at this dinner afterwards, they had a whole bunch of presentations about Action for Happiness, mm-hmm, and what their aspiration for the future is, and
yeah,
I was just very, very impressed. I never really understood it before,
mm-hmm,
and it's quite a wonderful vision and implementation. So I'm very happy that you're part of it.
And Action for Happiness have invested the resources in making great, you know, the course, for example. Because Anne and I have hosted that, you know, the 8
Are you both teachers of the course?
Anne and I both led one of the courses.
I see. Yep. Together.
Led it together.
Wonderful. And do you meditate in the course? Mindfulness is a part of it, they said, right?
Yeah. It's going the wrong way around. Just missed the turning. Don't worry. So what was that, John?
So it's, yeah, the mindfulness is part of the course.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, they said it was part of the course, but how much actual meditation practice is there in the course versus just talking about being present?
So out of the 8 weeks, there is 1 week solely dedicated
to practice,
to mindfulness. Uh-huh. But what we at the beginning of each of our lessons, we would have a tuning in session.
Oh, great!
Yeah.
And is that what everybody does, or is that what you did? Because
I think that's quite common.
Yeah, it's quite common.
It's common.
Uh-huh. It is quite common because in the videos and the structure that they give you, because we're not there to teach anyone, we're there to bring the concept.
Oh, facilitate.
Facilitate. Yes.
I see.
And to share with them.
I see.
We talked about this last time. You know, on the topic of Guillaume mentioning how wonderful social media is.
Yes.
And on the one hand, yes, for communication. But there was a recent NHS study in the National Health Service in the UK.
Yeah.
They surveyed 14 to 24 year olds.
Yes.
Digital natives. And the link between the rise, 70% increase in depression and anxiety in the last 25 years.
Really?
Yeah.
In that age group?
In that age group, and how the number one for increasing your anxiety and depression is Instagram.
There was a ranking of
the harmful effects of social media.
Yeah, yeah. And there's also a lot of, you know, dark stuff on social media, bullying and...
Yeah.
Things like that, right? Where
yeah,
you're just really putting other people down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on one hand, I keep saying to him, because I worry about my students. I see sort of zombie-like states. They're in the lift, they're waiting outside the lesson.
And they're tuned out.
They're tuned out. They're just, not having a conversation. You're
right.
17, 18.
Wow.
But you're in your own world. You're in.
What do you teach, by the way?
I teach mathematics.
You do?
Yeah.
In college?
So it's
a university.
It's not university. So it's we call it college in the UK, which is
what is
it? So it's the high school equivalent. It's the final 2 years.
Okay, of high school.
Of high school, okay. Yeah. So the secondary school is up till the age of 16, and then our college.
Uh-huh.
So we have.
Okay.
Is 16 to 18,
then you go to university.
Yeah.
If you do,
yeah.
So Anne, are you talking about the content on social media, is it,
versus the
addictive nature of always just turning to the phone and always being on the phone?
But yeah, I think, I mean, you look at people's social media. I mean, it's not a reality. It's literally something that people usually filter, you know, you've got those filtered lenses on Instagram. And I think to do with particularly teenage girls, there's an increase in depression in teenage girls in particular, right? And it's to do with, I think, body image, all of these things that at that vulnerable age, trying to grow up, get a sense of identity.
Absolutely.
and they're getting this false picture of reality, which they're so addicted to as well. You know, every moment is on the phone.
Yes, and it's always comparing yourself with other people, right? Yeah. I don't know Instagram. I've never even seen it. But is that the one where you just snap photos and then they disappear?
So there's Snapchat and then there's Instagram. I mean, okay. So Instagram's just photos. So it's like a very...
Instagram is just photos.
Just photos.
No text.
No text. I mean, you can add text at the bottom.
Yeah.
But it's mainly photos. Is that right, Guy?
Yeah, you use it to...
And Snapchat I've never used. I'm out of touch with that one completely. But that was number two on their list. So Instagram was number one.
Did we just go in a big circle?
Yeah.
What happened?
Because of the one-way system around here, once I'd missed that turning.
Oh, I see. I agree with you that we live in an age, you know, of social media, and you do have now digital natives, and they're not going to get anything except on the internet. Mm-hmm. And how do you do that in a way that really increases their quality of life, as opposed to... contributes to their addiction to social media.
But also if the vein or the mission statement is how do we spread mindfulness and I guess happiness through the back door to as many people as possible, you know, that is definitely...
Well, I'm a little mistrustful of the verb to spread.
Sure, okay. What do you mean?
So, well, because spreading mindfulness sounds like spreading peanut butter on a piece of bread, you know what I mean? And I question, so, you know, it doesn't mean that I don't appreciate what's underneath that, mm-hmm. but I would say, in a way, how would you ignite passion in someone for the deep wisdom that already is available to them? Okay, something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's called it igniting passion, so that rather than you're spreading something, mm-hmm. you're actually facilitating catalytically other people becoming more awake. It may sound like a subtle distinction, but one feels a little bit messianic. You know what I'm saying? Like,
what does that mean?
Messianic means like we've got the right thing here, and it's called mindfulness, or it's called happiness, and now we're going to spread it around the world. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it sounds a little bit arrogant. I mean, even if it comes from, you know, sort of compassion and from kind of the right perspective, if you're not careful, it can kind of, in ways that you don't really necessarily realize, be condescending to other people, like I'm telling you that you need to be happy,
yes,
or I'm telling you need to meditate. Well, how should I know what you need, you know? But if you can connect with people and say, listen, there is a way of being that actually allows us to deal with our unhappiness. Let's not focus so much on happiness, because then it sounds like you're selling happiness.
Yeah.
And of course, that's a tricky thing. But how about we bring awareness to how unhappy we are?
Mm-hmm.
And is it possible for us to free ourselves from the sort of core elements or patterns that drive unhappiness?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes, of course, but you have to start paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, in some sense, realize what it is and who it is that's unhappy.
Yeah.
What drives unhappiness? Is it wanting? Is it, you know, and what if you get what you want? Does that bring happiness? Very often, you just want something else.
Mm.
So you always want things to be your way, but then do you know what your real way is?
Mm.
And are there conditions that are available to you right now that are actually true causes of happiness, but you're not letting yourself experience them?
Yeah.
Like, the sky is getting lighter and lighter. It's absolutely beautiful. It's a brand new day. What's not to be happy about? Do you know what I'm saying? But if you're depressed, or if there's all sorts of stuff going on, or your house just burned down, or your family members were killed in the Grenville fire, there's a lot to not be happy about. But to have someone come along from Action and Happiness and talk about how you should be happy, well, who are you to say I should be happy? I mean, I'm grieving.
Mm-hmm.
dead family members.
Yeah.
So it's a tonal thing, of course. So that's where mindfulness comes in, because you can be aware, if you want to be, of how you're languaging your aspirations, whether it's action for happiness or whether it's mindfulness. And one way would be you're a kind of advocate or proponent for it, that has the, you know, potential to unwittingly become a little evangelical or messianic, that you know the right way and you're telling everybody else what the right way is. Yeah. So that's the danger. The love affair is you're sharing your enthusiasm for what you've experienced in your practice with other people, not to convince them that they should do that, but out of the joy, out of the happiness that you're experiencing, and you're sharing that, then people can say, wow, I saw this podcast with Guy and An, and they seemed like really awake, embodied, enthusiastic young guys, and they were talking about, say, whatever it is that they were talking about, whether it's philosophy or your child or anything, in a way that's like, I want to be like that. Do you know what I'm saying? Especially if you're appealing to younger people. I want to be like those guys when I grow up. Then, you see, there's a certain, I don't want to use the word purity, but there's a certain kind of authenticity where you're not telling someone else what to do. You cannot tell other people what to do without getting into some kind of dicey power relationship with them, where that does smack of a certain kind of arrogance.
Like my way's right.
Exactly, my way. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I spent so much time last night focusing on the personal pronouns. You know, that when we talk about my breath, who's talking, you know, or my body? And so we don't examine who we are, but we think we know what everybody else needs.
Yeah.
So happiness is something that, you know, I try not to talk that much about happiness. I talk about well-being, mm-hmm. feeling, or I'll use metaphors like, you know, the times when we feel most comfortable in our own skin. And everybody has probably had moments like that where you just feel like at home. Now, of course, that's what we always want. We want to always feel at home in your own skin. Then it's portable. You don't have to be at home to feel at home. You feel at home in your body. Now, most people don't feel at home with them in their body. And what you were saying about, you know, the young women and the pressures on them and the body image issues and everything else, like, you'll never be beautiful enough, you'll never be thin enough, you'll never be good enough. And this is a disease. I mean, it's like a social contagious disease that is infinitely harmful and leads to anorexia and suicide and all sorts of stuff. And to tell somebody, well, they should be happy, or, you know, we want you to be happy, it could backfire or not result in happiness. But to say, listen, there's more right with you than wrong with you. You are beautiful just as you are. Now, people are not necessarily going to be able to hear it, whatever it is that you're talking about. And, you know, if you're experiencing what I call the full catastrophe of the human condition, there are lots of moments in life where what mindfulness is about is feeling how unhappy you are. And then asking yourself, or feeling how much pain you're in. And it could be physical pain, it could be emotional pain. Is this okay, talking?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
And then you can ask yourself this really profound question, but it's a laboratory question. You're using your own life, whether you're unhappy or happy, whether you're in pain or not, to ask yourself questions like, let's say you're anxious, okay? And a lot of people are very anxious a lot of the time. But if you start to practice mindfulness and you cultivate that on a regular daily basis, both formally and in, you know, everyday life, when you're feeling anxious, you could bring awareness to it. You could embrace your your anxiety, the feelings of anxiety, wherever they are in your body, whatever kinds of thoughts are moving through your mind, however terrifying it is, you embrace it in awareness. As best you can.
Yeah.
You have to, of course, if you practice every day, you get stronger in your capacity to hold something in awareness, even if you don't want that something, you know, it's not pleasant. But if you hold it in awareness, then you can ask yourself the following question. Is my awareness of my anxiety anxious? Mm-hmm. And you look. You don't get out your book that tells you the answer, because there is no answer. But you look and you see, is my awareness of my anxiety anxious? Is my awareness of my discomfort uncomfortable?
Yeah.
And most of the time you will find, at least in my experience, that your awareness is bigger than your anxiety.
Yeah.
And it's a different dimension of reality of the mind that can actually hold it with a certain degree of compassion for yourself, of kindness for yourself. And then all of a sudden, you have the choice to step out of your anxiety into your awareness of your anxiety. And you know, the anxiety goes poof. It disappears, like touching a soap bubble.
Yeah.
Once you've had that experience once, you know it's possible, then anxiety doesn't become a prison for you. It becomes like a weather pattern, like, you know, it's raining. I don't want it to be raining, I want it to be sunny.
Yeah,
yeah, well, you may want it to be sunny, but it is raining. Mm-hmm. Now, how can you be in relationship to the fact that it's raining? Just allow it to be as it is, okay?
Yeah.
And you notice how unhappy you are about it, fine. But the noticing of the unhappiness, not unhappy, then you can have a good day on the rainy day.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean. And so I think whether it's action for happiness or, you know, a more classical MBS or a mindfulness approach, that it's really the challenge is to, I think, invite people to get to know themselves, to cultivate, as I said it last night, intimacy with their own capacity for awareness. And this is exactly what's never taught in school.
Yeah.
What's taught in school is thinking, and then judging on the basis of whether your paper's at the top of the pile or at the bottom of the pile, or whether you opened your mouth and you felt that what came out of your mouth was stupid, and then you will never open your mouth again.
Yeah.
And that's a form of violence that you're doing to yourself. Only other people, if they also are highly critical and put people down, and there's a lot of that that goes on, then you're letting other people actually run your life. But once you're aware of that, and you can pay attention to things like, you don't have to be on Instagram all the time finding out what everybody thinks about me. In fact, that's a kind of addiction, because as I understand it, I don't do this, so I only know about it from reading about it in the newspaper and so forth, that people are very often, and especially younger people who are so sucked into social networking, they'll say something on their Facebook page or something like that, you know, or I had a great time, or here's a picture of me or whatever, and then they'll keep going back to see how many people liked what they posted. And if not enough people liked what they posted, they'll get depressed.
Yeah.
And what they're looking for is little dopamine injections, dopamine hits.
Yeah.
They like my... So then your value is all based on what other people think, and you're perpetrating this delusion on yourself because the stuff wasn't important in the first place.
Yeah.
It wasn't you. You're just putting out, hey, how do you like this picture of me? Do I look beautiful in this picture? Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
You're beautiful already, no matter if you didn't take a picture.
Yes.
So can you reside in your beauty, and then don't post everything on Instagram or Snapchat or whatever, and have everybody else tell you how clever you are, how beautiful you are. What's the point of that? It's empty. And that's the kind of some path to depression, because you can never, ever satisfy that urge.
Yeah.
If 10 people think your post was wonderful, why didn't 100 people think my post is wonderful? Yeah. If it's 100, why didn't 1,000? I mean, if I was really popular, and then you said, you know, and then you start comparing yourself to movie stars or whatever, and they're as unhappy as you are.
Yeah.
So there's a certain way in which what mindfulness does, or, you know, true happiness, it invites you to actually stop and drop in to the actuality of your life, you know, and get really basic about it. Like, hey, am I having trouble breathing? Mm-hmm. No. Well, that's miraculous. I mean, there are a lot of people that they have to have oxygen. They can't breathe, you know. Someday I won't be breathing. Why don't I appreciate this moment, this breath? Do I need any more than that? I mean, and I don't have to be doing the breath because, as I said last night, if it were up to me to be breathing, I would have died a long time ago because I'm so distracted.
You tricked me yesterday. I put my hand up when you asked. You
said, of course, everybody does because that's the way the language works.
Yeah.
But you get my drift. So rather than sort of be evangelical and messianic around either happiness or mindfulness, which sooner or later is going to turn everybody off, what you want to do is be happy.
Yeah.
If you're happy, it's contagious.
Yes.
Why? Because people feel good in the presence of people who feel happy, who feel equanimous, who don't have issues, you know. When people are bullying other people, it's because they don't feel happy in themselves.
Yeah.
Or when they're just critical of everybody else and they, you know. So kindness and compassion are things that you can cultivate in yourself first, because we don't get enough kindness and compassion.
Yeah.
Everybody's so self-absorbed and preoccupied.
You're listening to the Action for Happiness Carpool podcast with the amazing Jon Kabat-Zinn.
So can I do a little bit of what Anne and I usually talk about and a bit of our So first of all, you know, what really shocked us was, you know, how much time we spend thinking throughout the day. And one evening I called Anne and I said, I had my first experience. I was in my car in traffic jam and I said, I'm so bored right now. And then I said, oh, that's a thought. And because I was doing my daily practice, it's like, I called Anne and I was laughing. I said, I can't believe it. I've just had that experience of changing a negative into a positive. And
but you didn't change it. See? You didn't change it any more than you took this breath.
Yeah.
You realized that you know, you had this thought.
Yes.
I'm bored. And then you held that thought in awareness and you realized it's just a thought.
Yeah.
Right? And that liberated you from the boredom.
Yeah, but what was profound for me as well thereafter was the next day, I did it like, I remember I actually counted four times when I noticed where I was like, just before the meeting with my boss, I was feeling those anxious feelings. Take a breath. And I noticed again, I said, wow, I've applied that tool again.
Right.
And then within a few weeks, it was, you know, 50 times a day. And I was like,
well, that's fantastic.
And then I kind of, me and Anne described it as like a, you know, if you imagine like a bar chart, if you will.
Yeah.
And let's just say for
argument. And you're charting your mindfulness moments.
Well, let's say for argument's sake that 50% of your day is in thought and 50% is you being present. That may not be the case, but let's say for this example, right? As we noticed the negative thought or a thought, it's like we were actually feeling the shift of this bar graph was now going more towards being the present side.
Being in the present. Yeah.
And so now it's like, you know, a couple of hundred times a day before I would usually get lost into a thought. Like, take a breath, be present. And it's like, wow. So I realized, well, how much time was I spending before this where I was like in a zombie mode?
Yeah.
Where I was in the shower, just physically
lost
there,
in thought.
But my mind is elsewhere. And it was almost a travesty that you know, we were living lives, you know, where the majority, well, I don't know what I'm saying majority, because I'm not too sure what the science says about how much time we are is thought. Some people say 70,000 thoughts a day. Some people say, you know, it varies, right? But we do know that we think a lot, because like a minute I close
almost,
my eyes,
it's almost constant.
Right. So it's if we say 50-50, but it's beautiful to see how this is now...
It can shift.
Wow, I'm now spending more time in the present moment. And that, for me, was so powerful. And the fact that, wow, I don't have to walk around a zombie anymore. And even when I do walk around a zombie, I can, like you said, drop that ball.
Yeah, snap out of it.
Snap out of it. And I think for me, that's almost like a superpower.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a nice way to put it. It is a superpower.
It is, because if you got these blinders on and like you're in bed and you're trying to forget the argument that you had with the guy at work and you can't get him out of your head.
Yeah.
But we come in with the superpower to even if momentarily, even if for that one instant, right?
And it's all about the one instant.
Yes.
It's all about the one instant. It's not a philosophy. So and that's where the image of the finger touching the soap bubble is so useful.
Mm.
Thought arises.
Yeah.
Awareness recognizes the thought.
Mm-hmm.
The thought doesn't lead to the next 20 thoughts.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you've liberated that thought.
Yeah.
And then there's just awareness.
Yes.
The next thought will arise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Then if, you know, so then... And thoughts have different powers because the content matters, the emotional charge matters. So after a while, you become intimate with the content of your thoughts and more than the content, the process that you see thoughts as events in the field of awareness.
Yeah.
And then we invest them with a lot of power, but they're just thoughts. They're like raindrops.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't have to actually imprison us or dominate our lives, but and then you can shift the balance to more open-hearted presencing, just here resting in awareness, walking down the street, and maybe you'll have thoughts because they're like weather patterns in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes there's lots of weather patterns, sometimes there's just low overhanging clouds all day long, and you feel like, you know, that's called depression or being down. And sometimes it doesn't even feel like thoughts, it just feels like a big cloud over your head. But then you realize that in some sense you don't have to do anything, that the weather patterns are dynamical, so sooner or later they're going to change. Why? Because everything changes. There's nothing that lasts.
Yeah.
But we think when we're feeling bad, it's going to last forever. Mm-hmm. When we're feeling good, it's going to last for no time at all. And then I'm soon going to be sad or bad, you know, angry or whatever. So that's just another wrong thought.
Yeah.
Lots of the problem with thought is not the thought. It's that the thoughts are, like, inaccurate.
Yeah.
The content of the thoughts is inaccurate, and they are freighted with a lot of emotion that is also unnecessary. And part of it is that most of the thoughts are about one subject and one subject only. And you know what that subject is, right? Me.
Yeah.
That's why it's important to pay so much attention to the personal pronouns. So you can be mindful of how much you talk about yourself or think about yourself. And it's staggering to realize how much time we spend telling the story of me to me.
Mm-hmm.
And me already knows the story of me, and it doesn't need to hear it.
Yeah.
But we keep doing it. And the story of what's wrong with me, or why I'm not happy, or who disrespected me or disregarded me, or or what I need in order to be happy, and none of it's really true.
Yeah.
Or it's true, but it's not true enough. So the narratives that we tell ourselves, and the kind of in that default mode that I was talking about in the brain last night, the trouble is that the content of it may be true to a degree, but what it leaves out is who you really are. It's the story of you is never as big as you.
Yeah.
And most of the time, like, you know, that's partly what life is about. Is like it's an ongoing trajectory in which you have the opportunity to realize how beautiful you are.
Yeah.
And you know, better.
So one question on that, John.
Yeah.
So you say who you really are. One of the subjects that Anne and I talk about is, yeah, so you can take a breath and be present, right? So you could be talking to me, then I start drifting off thinking about food, for example, right? And then I say, ah, use my tool, bring me back to the present moment.
Yeah.
And now I'm back with you, John.
Yeah.
But then what Anne and I were talking about is then, okay, well, what about the other way of being present, where it's like where the idea that the self is an illusion, you know, a lot of that Dan Dennett talks about and Sam Harris, how, so when I take that breath now, instead of being present back looking around, because, you know, we only see 4% of the visual spectrum, and the idea that our perception of who we are physically and in this world is, you know, more of a construct in our mind.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
The idea that when I take a breath, and instead of me being present back in this, we call it like in the game, for example.
Yeah.
It's like be present, but like when my eyes are closed, when it's like I'm not limited to the confines of my body or to this universe or to what I know, what I've assumed to be one way all my life, but that moment of taking a breath and like, well, you know, where is this place? What the hell is going on here? When it's this, when it's just consciousness, and it's like, wow. So like, when I take a breath now, instead of me, there is that in the game where it's like, yeah, I'm intertwined in this life, and I play this every morning when I wake up. For some reason, I'm in this world, and I'm Guillaume.
Yeah.
And I'm living it. But there's that other side to it. It's like when we take a breath, and there are no thoughts, and if there are no thoughts, and there's like the idea of who is Guillaume, you know, he's a married man with this, all of that is just something that is a thought that pops up.
That I was talking about.
Yes, it's that narrative. So that's what I'm saying, taking a breath to be present, but not so much in this reality, but present in just with no thinking, just being conscious.
Yeah, awake.
Awake.
I don't use the word conscious so much, but
awake,
aware. Aware, that's what.
But awareness coming from the point of not being the huge, like, limited to all the, our previous rules about what biology and physics.
But if you examine awareness, I think I said this last night. Yeah. I mean, no neuroscientist even knows what a thought is. They don't know what awareness is. They don't know how you get it out of 3 pounds of meat in the head, even though it's trillions of neurons. No one knows how that happens.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's in some sense our human birthright. You could say that's what really makes us human, is our capacity to wake up and not be imprisoned by thoughts, emotions, sensations, the body, you know, especially if the body's in pain or anything, but to just, be the knowing and the not knowing that your awareness not only already is, but always has been. So then you can get philosophical about it, but there's a danger to do that. Then, you know what that is? That's just all more thinking.
Yeah.
And you can say, oh, well, that the kind of thinking is positive thinking, and, you know, and it's so much fun to think about multiverses and consciousness and what the real meaning of life is, and all this, but it's just thinking, thinking, thinking. Yeah. The real meditation practice is how you live your life from moment to moment.
Yeah.
So... yeah, black squares, white squares. One Zen master said, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Okay? Sometimes it goes this way, sometimes it goes that way.
Yeah.
Day, night, black, white. And what we're cultivating is wisdom. We're cultivating equanimity. We're cultivating allowing things to be as they are. And the awareness that is aware of things as they are isn't caught in any of it. Now, that doesn't mean if you lose your job, if you're fired, maybe you'd be depressed for a couple of weeks or a couple of months. All right, so be depressed for a couple of months.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that? Why should you, if you're a meditator, then you start telling yourself, I'm a meditator, I should get over this.
Yeah.
You know? But who says you should get over it? Why don't you just experience what it feels like, and the disappointment, and the, how hard it is maybe to get a job, and then anxiety about that, yeah. And then a feeling of lack of self-worth. And then you ask that very same question that I asked you before. Is my awareness of my anxiety, anxious, is my awareness of my low self-esteem, is that actually suffering from any kind of low self-esteem?
Yeah.
And the answer will be no. Because your awareness is already pure. Then you don't have to get anything. Mm-hmm. You don't have to get anywhere. You're residing in your truer nature rather than being caught up perpetually in thinking. And even good thinking is still thinking.
Right.
So this is something where, but let's not turn it into an ideal. The awareness is that way already. But it may take you 10 or 15 years to realize that.
Sure.
And learn how to live inside it. And even so, if someone dies or you go through some kind of big loss or change or threat, that's huge. And so put the welcome mat out for all of it. Do you know what I'm saying? The black squares, the white squares, and the awareness of the black isn't colored black, and the awareness of the white isn't colored white.
Sure, yeah.
That's what I would say.
Okay. All right, so...
And here we are. Long stay. You know, your beauty, your health, your well-being, your brain, everything about you, it's never going to get any better. It's only going to get older. So what the real invitation is to be who you already are, not to become somebody else.
I love it.
And that's hard work, because we always want to improve on ourselves. There's no improving on you, because you're already a Buddha. Yeah. You just don't remember that you're a Buddha. So a lot of the time.
Beautiful.
So that's the thing. And you guys, I mean, I don't talk like this with everyone, because, you know, I don't meet that many people who have as pure a motivation as the two of you. You know, and that so much enthusiasm, and also so much background and intelligence and education. It's fabulous. So just, I would say, the most important thing is to not think about it too much. Sure. If you get too philosophical about it, it will all be thinking, and this is not about thinking, it's about awarenessing. Turn it into a verb,
okay.
A present participle, awarenessing. And then see what that does, so that life itself becomes the laboratory. Of course, do you have children?
I don't know.
But you have a live-in Zen master with you, so he's going to teach you everything you need to know.
Okay.
And remember, if you'd like to create a kinder and happier world, please get involved with Action for Happiness. You can join thousands of others who are helping to spread a bit more happiness in their homes, workplaces, schools, and local communities. Find out more at actionforhappiness.org. Join the movement, be the change.